she peke jak she Janchu badu dani kyapsuchi nage chenye gipe sonam ge drola penchi sange drupa shu chedan sange chonam la janchu badu dani kyapsuchi nage chenye gipe sonam ge drola penchi sange drupa shu Chedan Sange Chonam La Janchu Badu Dani Kyapsuchi Nage Chenye Gipe Sonam Gi Drola Penchi Sange Drupa Shu
So, Rinpoche yesterday went through the teachings on the way to rely upon a spiritual teacher, followed up by the six preparatory practices as the preliminary section for one's meditation. So, today Geshe-la thought of going through the six preparatory practices. So then the preparation, so relying upon a spiritual teacher is done for the sake of one's practice. So that is the reason for relying upon a spiritual teacher, so that we will be able to put those teachings into practice. So then in doing so, we begin with the six preparatory practices, which are the preliminary stage for one's meditation session. It's just like, for example, if you think of cooking a meal, then first of all, you will prepare all the ingredients. You will prepare all the veggies and the oil and the other ingredients that will go into your meal. And then in the actual stage, you will put them together in a mix when you cook them. So similarly, when you sit for your meditation session, you begin with the preparatory practices. So for those of you who have the text, if you look at page 94, those six preparatory practices are listed down. The first one is clean well the place where you are staying and neatly arrange the representations of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind. So we have two activities here condensed into the first preliminary practice. So they are cleaning the place and preparing representation of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind. The second one is obtain offerings without deceit and arrange them beautifully. The third is sit up straight upon a comfortable seat in a suitable posture, your legs either in a full or half lotus position, and so on and so forth. That is sitting for your meditation posture. The fourth one is imagine that sitting in the space before you are the gurus of the vast and profound lineages, which means that visualizing the field of accumulation in front of you. And then with respect to them, you correct your mind in forms of the seven limbs of the seven limbs of worships. And then the last preparatory practice is offering, making the Malanda offering. This is something that all of us can do. We can all practice the six preliminary practices. And this is also coming up in the Life Story of Lama Tsenlimpa. Actually, the six preparatory practices are drawn from sources such as the instructions taken from the life story of Lama Tsenlimpa. So we begin with the first preparatory practice, which is cleaning well the place where you're staying. So we clean the place where we're going to stay, which means that if you live in a place where you have a dedicated room for your Dhamma practice, you clean that room. In Tibetan, it's called the Dhamma room or the Dhamma hall. And it is very likely that not all of you will have a dedicated room for that. So basically, you clean the place where you're going to perform your meditation practice. And the mental attitude that you take up as if you are going to invite a Lama to reside there. So, you know, if you were to invite someone to reside in that place, a Lama, you would prepare the place, clean the place, and so forth. So first of all, you clean the place, and then you arrange representations of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind. And in arranging those representations, there could be different forms of arranging it. Sometimes if you see people arranging their altar with representation in which the Buddha images, tankas, statues, and so forth are found at the extremities or the, you know, outside of the main figures on the altar. In the middle, you will either have a photo of your lama or a deity and so forth, but this is not the right way of doing that, Geshe-la said.
Mau yunadir, cugang tunggu yunadir. Cuando
So then, Geshe said in the previous section that when you arrange those representations of body, speech, and mind, statues, images, and so forth, it's good to keep the Buddha figure as the central one. And this is also, of course, with the advice of His Honor, the Dalai Lama, because the Buddha is the teacher that we rely upon. So then we arrange those representations. It is said that you obtain offering without a seat. The third one is sitting straight up on a comfortable seat in a suitable posture. So it also says that you need to absorb yourself in the practice of going for refuge, developing the mind of enlightenment. And if you feel sleepy or lethargic, you can walk about in order to to make yourself kind of woken up or more refreshed. Anyway, it is said that as you sit down for your meditation session, if you're fully ordained, then you should be sitting in a seat that is not elevated more than a cubit, which means more than an arm length. If you're Gelon or a Gretzel, then your seat shouldn't be that high. Probably you could say that it also applies to a lay practitioner. So then it is said that you sit down in a posture that is called the seven-point Vairochana posture. So we have Buddha Vairochana, which is symbolic of the purified foam aggregate, right? So the purification of the foam aggregate arises in the form of Buddha Vairochana. And there are seven features that are associated with the body of Vairochana. So when we train ourselves in our meditation posture and assuming that meditation posture, we then train in those habitual tendencies or those patterns by which in the future we will arise into a body of a Buddha. Now, it is also said that as you arrange your seat, then you can place under your seat a representation of a svastika. Now, for those of you who might find it a bit strange, the svastika is actually a kind of, I think, an inverted svastika. Anyway, this is symbolic of, you know, in Buddhist iconography, it is symbolic of stability and also longevity, having a stable life. So you can arrange svastika under your seat. Also, you can place kusha grass, a particular type of grass, which is also symbolic of the exhaustion of impurities. So in order to remove or to exhaust or eliminate impurities, you can arrange kusha grass under your seat. There is also another type of grass, which is called fragmented grass, which is also symbolic of longevity. So all of those things are also mentioned in the life story of the Buddha. So in some sense, you can also say that it is a good thing to do because it will help you to recollect the Buddha.
Segmentata, a volte viene molto lunga, che sta per terra,
questa invece è l'auspicio di lunga vita. Questo erano il modo in cui, dove si sedeva sopra Buddha Shakyamuni, per cui per ripetere le stesse azioni avere quel tipo di auspicio. Non so.
Also, it is said that it is good to sit where your behind is slightly elevated. It helps your posture. So, if you sit cross-legged and you think of the level of your ankles or feet, if it is said that if they are around the same level of the seat, it is helpful. So, in that sense, your backside would be elevated. Now, in the 7-point Vajrasana posture, it is mentioned that you sit in the Vajra posture. Sometimes in English we call it the lotus posture, but in the way that it is referred to in Tibetan is the Vajra posture. And Rinpoche spoke about it yesterday. He said that the left leg is drawn in and the right one is resting on top of it. So if you can sit like that, that's good. If you cannot sit like that, then you can sit in half lotus posture, or you can sit in the way that we normally sit here, like for example now. Or you can, if that is difficult, in some scriptures it is said that you can also adopt the position of the Venerable Tara, where you have the left leg drawn in and the right one slightly extended. So this is also permissible if you find that comfortable. So you can look at the palms position as Geshe-la is demonstrating. So then you place your two hands in an equipoise posture so that you place your, first of all, your left palm, then your right palm on top of it, then the two thumbs are touching each other, and are placed around the level of the navel, as Rinpoche did yesterday. So Rinpoche yesterday explained how, from a scientific perspective, it has some correlation to the system of neurons that goes on from our brain through the arms and meeting up at the thumbs. Or you can also look at it from the point of view of High Yoga Tantra that explains the system of channels that run through our body. It is said that there are that in High Yoga Tantra, our goal is to make the winds enter and bite and dissolve into the central channel. So, the touching of the two palms, the two thumbs together, is also in order to place some imprint so that along the practice of High Yoga Tantra, we will be able to make the winds enter, abide, and dissolve into the central channel.
Anche il fatto che vengono tenute all'altezza dell'ombelico, anche quello è un punto fondamentale della pratica dello stato del completamento, ha a che fare con questo, col fatto che in futuro c'è l'auspicio poi di poter far maturare queste pratiche. Non so.
Sembi
Now, with respect to your sitting posture, your back should be kept upright, right? So it should be straight in order to facilitate a free flow of winds along the central channel. As together with winds come minds, right? Winds act as man for minds. It will also allow this flow of consciousness. When you look at it from the perspective of Tantra or Mantra, our goal is to reach that single operation, that unanimous operation of both winds and minds. So keeping a back upright and back straight facilitates that. So this is with respect to keeping the back upright or straight. The shoulders should be leveled, right? So you should sit with your two shoulders leveled. So, in going through the 7-point Varachana posture, now Geshe-la is speaking about the 5th point in that posture, which is your eyes should be gazing around the tip of your nose. Now, it doesn't mean to say that you should focus your eyes at the tip of the nose as if you keep them crossed. It's rather to say that rather than observing far and wide, or shutting your eyes, your eyes should be getting downwardly around the area that is pointed, you know, from the tip of your nose. If you keep your eyes open and you gaze far and wide, there is a danger that you will fall prey to excitation, anger, attachment, and so forth. And if you shut your eyes, there is a danger that lethargy or laxity will set in. Now, also, your neck is slightly bent, which means that you're not, that's the 6th one, so your neck is slightly bent, it's not resting backwardly. Again, it is said that it's better to sit when your neck is slightly bent so that excitation will not kick in. Now, the 7th point in the 7-point Varachana posture is that your tongue should be resting on the upper palate so that your mouth will not be generating excessive saliva or will not go dry so that, you know, you become thirsty. And your lips should be resting in a natural posture, not tightly shut. So then the 7-point Varachana posture, when you think about it, it's not something that we cannot adopt. So we take it up in our meditation, daily meditation practice. So if you're doing your prayers, if you're doing the different recitations, you adopt that posture so that on a daily you become used to it, so that it's not that you sit at the end in a posture that is not an advisable or suitable posture. So we prepare ourselves to the actual practice. So also our sitting posture is something that we get into in order to facilitate our practice, so that on that basis we'll be able to shape to shape a mind up. We want to form a mind to make it take a certain shape. We want to make sure that anger, attachment, and other afflictions will not easily arise, for we can see that normally they easily arise in our mind. So if they easily arise in our mind, first of all, we start doing in our meditation is initially we meditate on the breath in order to create a neutral state of mind so that afflictions will not easily arise. So it is said that meditating on the breath is helpful. So then you start focusing on the breath. So breathing out and breathing in is one count, right? So there are not two counts. You breathe out and you breathe in, and that's one breath. So you do a cycle of 21 breaths, and you count 21. You can count it either in a forward order, which means 1, 2, 3, 4, and so forth, or you can count it backward, 21, 20, 18, 19, and, 19, 18, and so forth. So you do a round of 21 breaths, and you don't breathe heavily, right? It's not that you exert your breathing process. You let it rest naturally, and like that you count rounds of 21 breaths. You can count one round and then another round. You follow your breathing process in a natural way so that your mind will be resting in a state that is a natural state.
Condizione di neutralità e questa condizione di neutralità rende molto più facile prendere possesso di questa mente e indirizzarla dove poi vogliamo nella meditazione. No,
So I left out something. So Geshe said that also, since breathing is something that we have naturally, then we have something that we can work with in order to create a neutral state of mind. So if you do those cycles of 21 breaths for a certain direction, you can do it for even like 20 minutes in order to engender this neutral state of mind, and you can take it on a daily basis. So if you take it up on a daily basis, you will create this habit of first of all developing a neutral state of mind at the beginning of your meditation. Now, it is said that you do a round of 21 breaths. You do not count more than that, because if you start counting more than that, add a lot of numbers, a lot of counts, great count to it, your mind will be susceptible to excitation. Whereas if you keep the count shorter, 1, 2, and 3, and then do it again, there is a danger that laxity will set in. So a count of 21 breaths is advisable.
Yo también yo van a sentir en esos
Then going back to the six preparatory practices, the fourth one is visualizing the field of accumulation in front of you. So in visualizing the field of accumulation, you can visualize, for example, the field of accumulation of the Lamrim lineage, in which you meditate on the Buddha as being the central figure. And on one side, you have the lineage of the vast and extensive conduct, and on the other side, you will have the lineage of the profound view. So in visualizing in this way the lineage lamas, you visualize the field of accumulation. Now it is called the field of accumulation, for in relation to that you accumulate the collections and purify obscurations. Now it's in order to study the details of the lineage lamas, you might use a tanka of the lamas of the Lamrim. So it's not that you're sitting and gazing on the tanka. This is not the way to meditate on the field of accumulation in gazing on a tanka. It's rather that you take the tanka as a reference, study the details, and make it appear to your mind as a mental image. So then we, then in relation to the field of accumulation, we do the practice of the seven limbs of worship. So with the seven limbs of worship, we begin with the limb of paying homage, obeisance, making prostration. So we do prostrations with our body, speech, and mind, which means that commonly, you know, we take them as common as a body, speech, and mind, or shared as a token of paying homage. And we can also pay homage individually or separately with our body, speech, and mind, as it is indicated in the limbs of in the seven limbs in the prayer of Samantabhadra Kondak, the king of prayer. I'll just try to retrieve those verses in a second. It's good that I have a phone with me. But the first verse in that prayer, the king of prayers, says that... anyway, try to come out to find that prayer. So it says, O lions among men, Buddhas past, present, and future, to as many as you exist in the ten directions, I bow down with my body, speech, and mind, right? So we think about them in the past, present, and the future. So then, we pay homage with our body, speech, and mind. So we might rise up from a seat and bow down, and this is paying homage with our body. We also, with our speech, we go for refuge, or we, you know, recite some eulogies. So, you know, with a speech, we go for refuge in our mind. We will think of the good qualities of those beings in the field of accumulation, and this is paying homage to them with our mind. So then the second verse in the King of Prayer says, on waves of strength of this king of prayer, for exalted sublime ways. Just a second. All right. So, on waves of strength of this King of Prayers, of four exalted sublime ways, with bodies as numerous of atoms in the world, I bow down to the Buddha's pervading space. So, in that sense, we pay homage to them individually with our bodies. So, if we can think that we emanate bodies as numerous as the atom of the world, that's going to contribute to a greater accumulation of merit. When we will reach a higher realization, we'll be able to do it in actuality. But currently, we can even think about it, and that will contribute to a greater accumulation of merit. So then the third verse in the King of Prayer says, on every atom are Buddha's numerous as atoms, each amidst a host of bodhisattvas, and I am confident that the sphere of all phenomena is entirely filled with Buddhas in this way. So we will be thinking, how is it possible, right? There are so many tiny atoms in the world, and in each one of them is seated Buddha together with a retinue of bodhisattvas. So it might indeed be difficult to conceive of how would that be possible, but if we think about it from the perspective of the common presentation in which, for a Buddha, their body, speech, and mind are a single entity. Since the body, speech, and mind are a single entity, you can say that, therefore, it is suitable for them to fit on one atom. Or if you look at it from the perspective of the tantric presentation, in the tantric presentation, we speak of a union of body and mind. We speak of a union of winds and minds. So, therefore, it is also suitable from a tantric perspective. From the perspective of the common presentation, you can say that since the Buddha's mind is omniscient and it knows all phenomena, it also knows each and every individual atom. So, wherever the knowledge of a Buddha exists, since the body, speech, and mind Buddha are inseparable, they are indivisible entity. Also, you can think that the body of a Buddha is there. So, rather than thinking that how do they fit sitting, not all of them fit sitting on an atom, you can think that wherever there is the knowledge of a Buddha, no, whatever phenomenon is known by a Buddha, since the body, speech, and mind of a Buddha are indivisible, you'll also find the body of a Buddha there.
No.
Then the next verse, number 4, says, with infinite oceans of praise for you and oceans of sound from the aspects of my voice, I sing the breathtaking excellence of Buddhas and celebrate all of you gone to bliss. So here we pay homage with our speech. And as we pay homage with our speech, we speak of the good qualities of the Buddhas. So if you think about it, we've emanated countless bodies, numerous as the atoms of this world, and we make prostrations with them. So we can also think that each one of those bodies have also many heads, and each one of them has a mouth that that sings or announces praises to the Buddhas. So like, for example, one of the verses that is used often at the beginning of the teachings is, I pay homage to Gautama Buddha, the one that has severed the net of wrong conceptions and motivated by conception taught it to others. So we praise in that way the love and compassion of all the Buddhas, and through that we accumulate inconceivable merit. So we have looked at the section of making homage or paying homage shared with our bodhisattva mind, and the one that is individual to our bodhisattva mind. And after that, in the seven limbs, comes a limb of making offerings, and we make surpassable offerings and unsurpassable offerings. The surpassable offerings are offerings of flower garlands and the like. So in this way we make surpassable offering before we make offerings that are unsurpassable. In the King of Prayer, it says beautiful flowers and regal garlands, sweet music, scented oils and parasols, sparkling lights and sublime incense I offer to you, victorious one. So you offer such surpassable offerings, such as the one that we make here. So we have flowers and flower garlands and water bowl offerings and a flower outside. We can offer all of them, and they're considered to be surpassable offering in that there could be also offerings that are higher to them.
Tenedi 최악의 전달된 영양제가 전달된다. 가시시로 수술은 누가 투발 지 누가 지고 있다. 내 지원이나 라면 내도 지고. 어때나 지금 대강에니 수술 소난데 최대 제일 큰 최대 수술 소난 지역으로 어때 메소다 대대 이동 먹고 대대 수술 인상에 봐 이게 큐 어때 큐와 이나 따지 라면 내도 지고 있어.
So then we spoke about making suppressible offering, making offerings of flowers, garlands, and so forth. Then at the bottom of page 96 in our text of the Lambrim, there is an explanation of making unsurpassable offerings. Using a verse, I imagine all unsurpassable and vast offerings for all the conquerors. With the strength of my faith in auspicious deeds, I bow down and make offerings to all of the conquerors. Surpassable offerings are those of worldly persons. Therefore, unsurpassable offerings are completely good things created by those with power, such as bodhisattvas, which means that those that can use their mental strength in order to emanate countless types of offerings. So currently, we are unable to make such offerings in actuality, but later on, as we will develop the power of the mind, as bodhisattva would be able to do, to make such offerings which are emanated by the mind. And that also is in agreement with a statement that we covered previously with respect to our progression along the stages of study, reflection, meditation. It says that whatever we study, we seek to study so that we would be able to put it into practice, so that even if we're unable to practice it currently at the present, we should make aspirations so that we would be able to put it into practice in the future. That should be our attitude. So also here, with respect to unsurpassable offerings, you might say that even if you do not have the ability now to emanate such offerings, that you think, you imagine that you're making inconceivable offerings emanated by your mind, and this is unsurpassable offerings. So then, in making surpassable and unsurpassable offerings, beginning with making surpassable offerings, like, for example, arranging offerings in a way that we arranged it here, when you compare that to the way that offerings used to be made in Tibet, the Himalayan region, Ladakh, there weren't many things to use in order to make such offerings, like a variety of biscuits and flowers and so forth. Those areas were more barren. So people used to make offerings that were made of tsampa. But the tsampa that was used for making those offerings was kind of a poor quality of tsampa of poor quality. So people used to store the tsampa of good quality so that they could eat that. But then the one that was not of good quality was used for offering on the altar. So when you think about it, it's not actually the way to do it, right? It's not the right attitude with respect to making offerings. So now we have a great variety of things. So looking at what we offer here on the altar, and since that we also follow suit, we also follow the examples of more contemporary practitioners, and, you know, for example, the Ben Society, that have found better ways of making offerings. So we offer biscuits or other varieties of food on the altar, and it's good to change it every couple of days or so. So you make fresh offerings. Then after 2 days, you replace them. You refresh your offerings. You offer some new things, and you can eat the offerings that were offered previously. So in that way, you work on extending your accumulation of merit. So that might bring out a doubt in your mind. If you have made offerings and you have offered them to the Buddha, is it suitable for me to eat those offerings after a while? Is it suitable for me to make use of those offerings? It accords with, you know, this doubt also accords with something that is found in the Vinaya, on the tradition of disciplining. It is said that when one has offered certain things, certain substances to the Buddha, then you have relinquished them on the mental level, and therefore they are no longer yours. Or if you have thought of giving something to another person, and in your mind you have given it to them, then it is no longer yours, right? So you cannot make use of it for your own sake, because it is no longer yours. So then, if you think about it like that, it is still possible to consume of things that were previously offered to the Buddha, because we also offer a body, speech, and mind to the Buddha, and as such, you can say that as my body, speech, and mind were offered to the Buddha, I'm considered to be of the same household or in the retinue of the Buddha. Now, the third limb out of the seven limb is the limb of confession. As page 97 quotes a verse, whatever sins or negativities I have done with body, speech, and mind, under the influence of attachment, hostility, or ignorance, I confess each and every one of them. So we need to confess our negativities using the four powers of the antidote. So within the four powers of the antidote, the first one is the power of the basis, which is also called the power of support. So we can use Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as a reference for the confession of our negativities. The second power is called the power of repudiation, in which you generate a deep sense of regret, as if you have taken poison for the negative actions that you have done before. The third power is called the power of turning away from negativities, in which you restrain your mind and you think that I shall not perform those negativities again in the future. That's the third power. And the fourth one is called the power of thorough application of the antidote, in which you take up those practices that we regularly or commonly do, different recitations and so forth, and you do them as much as you can. This is the fourth power, of the power of thorough application of the antidotes. So altogether, the four powers are: the first one, power of the support; the second is the power of repudiation, or the power of regret; third one is the power of turning away from negativities, the power of restraint; and the fourth one is the power of thorough application of the antidote.
Thank you.
No, it says in that verse, I confess each and every one of them. Sometimes we say individually. So to confess each and one of them individually can also be linked up with the power of the basis that we use in order to confess our negativities and the avenues that we use in order to create those negativities. So now you can say that outwardly we have the objects of refuge, so we have created negativities with respect to those objects of refuge. So the power of the support that we use in order to purify that is going for refuge. Whereas, you say, downwardly, the avenue that we use in order to create negativity is a sentient being. So then the power of the support that we use in order to purify negativities is compassion and the mind of enlightenment. So the confession of our negativity is a very important practice. We might think of what we need to do in order to again secure a rebirth as a human being. We said that further, we need to create the basis which is created in terms of guarding pure ethical discipline. So in terms of ethical discipline, we can recognize that we have many contradictions or many violations of our ethical discipline. At some point, we might be thinking that there's no hope for me anymore because I violate my ethical discipline repeatedly. But still, even that can be purified using a process of confession and purification that employs the four powers of the antidote. So it's just like you might get sick and then recover. It doesn't mean that you cannot get sick again. So you constantly apply yourself to a purification process by means of the four powers. So then, when we think of the avenues for creating negativities, negative actions, the first avenue, the first way of creating them is through not knowing. Through not knowing what constitute negative actions, we end up taking one, and that leads us to a miserable rebirth in the next lifetime, in one of the miserable states of existence. It is said that actually for the wise, which means for the learned, even slight negativities become even heavy negativities become light, and for the unwise, the unlearned, even light negativities become heavy. So the first avenue in that sense of creating negativities and the power that influences the weight of negativities is knowledge, knowing or unknowing what they are or how we perform them. It's just like, not just to illustrate that with an analogy, you can say that if you have a metal chain, each one of the links in that chain will sink down to the bottom of the ocean, let's say, even if it's tiny. It will be still heavy. Or you can have something that is made of a light material that even when it is cast in the water, it will still be floating on the surface. Anyway, this analogy is illustrative. It's illustrating how for some people, heavy negativities can become light. For others, slight negativities will become heavy.
Namaya Pasha, Dari Lama Dam, Sanjay Johnson, Tuesday, Hana, Dinde,
Now the next branch within the seven limbs of worship is rejoicing. So you can rejoice in your own virtue and you can rejoice in the virtue of others. When you rejoice in the virtues of yourself, you can think to yourself that that was a very good thing that I've done. That was a very good virtue. This is due to the blessing of my root lama, due to the blessings of the Buddha. How fortunate I am to be able to do that. And if you think about it in this way, your virtue grows and increases. It is, in some sense, you can use the following analogy in order to get your head around it. So if you have a lump of money, if you store it in your house, you're not going to get any interest. It would not grow and increase. Whereas if you deposit it in a bank, you can get some interest on it so that your lump of money will grow bigger and bigger. So rejoicing in your own merit is just like that, in your own virtue, sorry, it's just like that. Your virtue grows and increases. Now, rejoicing in the virtues of others is also a skilled way of increasing your merit. It is said that when you rejoice in the virtues of others, your virtue, your merit can amount to the same merit that the other person have accumulated through that performance of virtue. So you can either rejoice in the virtues of those that are lesser than you or those that are higher than you in order to match up or in order to exceed the amount of merit or virtue that they have created. So this is also a skilled method in generating the accumulation of merit. So we speak about using rejoicing as a way to increase our virtue. We possess vows. Geshe said that, for example, he as a monastic possesses a vow, which is also a basis for the increase in virtue. But it's not that only monastics can use a vow as a basis for increasing virtue. Also, lay people can do it. Like, for example, sometimes his honor as a Dalai Lama in giving teachings, he says that, right, for those lay people that want to take the vow of approaching virtue, which is also called the lay vow, this is the time to do it. So you guys can also use the vow of approaching virtue, the lay vow, as a basis for the increase in virtue. So if you guard well your vow, so within the vow you have the four roots, and the additional one of not of abstaining from intoxicants, right? So if you have such a vow, then that is a basis for increasing your virtue. Yesterday in the teaching, in going over the seven names of worship, Captain Rinpoche mentioned that story of a beggar that was rejoicing in a king's charity. So Geshe-la wanted to add a few details to that story. So the story tells about this king that was distributing himself gifts or sustenance to a great community of monastics. And there was a beggar that was standing at the end of that crowd, and he was thinking to himself that that's excellent. If I had money, I would try to do it as the king does it. That is excellent. The Buddha was there also present in that great audience. And at the end of that act of charity, the Buddha dedicated the virtue that the king has accrued, and he mentioned the name of that beggar that was standing at the end. And the king was quite surprised. He said, "No, what's the deal with that? What's going on? I was the one who was making those offerings. How was the one that created that act of charity? Why is it that you're dedicating it for the sake of that person, that beggar?" So the Buddha said, "Well, you were the one that distributed the food, but the beggar was rejoicing in your virtue, and therefore that beggar was accruing the same degree of virtue that you have created. So I dedicated it for the sake of that person as well." So that illustrates that with the act of dedication, the merit or the virtue that we accrue could amount to the same merit or virtue as the person that has done that action. Then the next limb within the seven limbs of worship is requesting to turn the wheel of Dharma. As the king of prayer says, "You are the bright lights of the world in 10 directions who have attained Buddha's omniscience through the stages of awakening. All of you are my guides. Please turn the supreme wheel of Dharma." So we can think about it in terms of, for example, Buddha Shakyamuni, that for us, turn the wheel of Dharma. We can think about it in relation to any Buddha. Now, we make such requests to turn the wheel of Dharma, and yet, you know, when we think of ourselves in terms of our practice, we might discover that our practice is not going that well, that we're quite negligent in terms of our practice. So, we sometimes come together and do certain recitations together. Like, for example, there is a brief recitation in one verse in which we list down the seven limbs of worship. I pay homage, I make offerings, I confess, I rejoice, I ask to turn the wheel of Dharma, not to pass it into Nirvana, I dedicate all my merit. All of it is in one verse. His Honor says that, it seems that you guys are not practicing, but you come together and make those prayers. So what's the go with that? What's the deal with that? So when we think about the message of His Honor, not only we can make such prayers that consist of those seven limbs, but our intention should be actually to take it up in a practice, to study more and genuinely put it into practice. Now the next limb within the seven limb is the supplication, requesting not to pass into Parinirvana.
Thank you.
So then, the last limb, the seventh one, is the limb of dedication. And we make different dedications. Like, for example, one of the verses that we use is, in order to train like the hero Manjushri, who knows reality as it is, and just like Samantabhadra as well, I completely dedicate all this goodness just as they did. Like, for example, Samantabhadra dedicated his virtue in a way that is demonstrated in the King of Prayers. So when we think of this way of dedicating a marriage, first of all, we make sure that all the virtue, all the merit that we have accrued would be dedicated to the state of the Buddha so that it will act as a cause for Buddhahood. That's one reason. The second one is in order to prevent it from degenerating. So we do not want a virtue to degenerate. Dedication is an act of safeguarding a virtue so that they will not degenerate. So then, we said that in order to safeguard the virtue that we accrue, we dedicate our virtue. So, it is said that for someone that is prone to getting angry, anger is something that destroys the roots of virtue that were thus accumulated. In actual fact, Geshe said, thinking about it, even if we dedicate our virtue, it is very likely that anger will still destroy our roots of virtue. In order to explain that, Geshe was drawing from a few sources. The first one is Chandrakirti's supplement to the Middle Way. In the first chapter, the first mind generation of the supplement to the Middle Way, when Chandrakirti was speaking of generosity, he said that the accumulations gathered over 100 eons of practicing generosity, ethics, and so forth will be destroyed by an instance of anger. Shantideva spoke about it in a way that is slightly different in this Gaita Bodhisattva way of life. Rather than saying that the accumulations gather over hundreds of years of practicing generosity, ethics, and so forth, he spoke about the accumulations that we gathered over thousands of eons, right? So we have two numbers, one of them over 100 eons, second one is over 1,000 eons. So there is a difference between Chandrakirti and Shantideva in their text. So in order to then reconcile the difference between those two texts, the following explanation is given. So when Chandrakirti speaks of the destruction of the accumulation of the accumulation gathered over 100 eons, when Shantideva, I'll begin with that, when Shantideva speaks about accumulations accumulated over thousands of eons, it is the case of a non-bodhisattva getting angry at a bodhisattva. So a greater accumulation of virtue will be destroyed. When Chandrakirti refers to the accumulation that was gathered of 100 eons, he speaks about a higher bodhisattva getting angry at a lower bodhisattva. Now, Jerimo Chenlama Tsongkhapa in his Illumination of the Thought also clarifies that, and he says that that destruction refers to those virtues that are contained within the accumulation of merit. So when Lama Tsongkhapa in his Illumination of the Thought, so Lama Tsongkhapa in his Illumination of the Thoughts specifies that anger destroys those virtues that are found in the accumulation of merit, not in the accumulation of exalted knowledge or exalted wisdom. Geshe-la reckons that this is probably the case because the virtues that are found in the accumulation of wisdom refers to realizations of emptiness. So if you have develop ascertainment of emptiness, in that if you have come to ascertain it with valid cognition, you realize emptiness, you're not going to forget it, since this is a realization, and therefore from that point onwards it's not going to be forgotten. Then virtues that are found in that accumulation will not be forgotten, will not be destroyed, sorry. So it is said that, for example, through making prostrations to Buddha and paying homage to Buddha in this way, making prostrations, you accumulate the merit that will enable you to take a rebirth as a chakravartin, which means a will-turning king in this world. So then someone might say that, well, I mean, looking at reality, we are not born as will-turning kings, are we? It's not that we are born as chakravartins, so why is it stated like that? Well, you can also say that since we're so prone to anger, then there's also a lot of destruction of virtues that we create. Now, even virtues such as paying homage to Buddha.
Then the same thing,
Now, if you wonder why is it that anger destroys the roots of virtue, well, we can think about it in terms of analogies. So suppose that you have a piece of cloth, like let's say a tablecloth. So it is dirty, there's some pieces of dirt in it, so you take it up and you start shaking it so that all those pieces of dirt, you dust them away. In a similar way, you can say that we might have those virtues that we place upon a mind stream, but when anger arises, it makes a mind stream become completely stirred up. You know, it becomes completely disturbed, completely distorted. So it since becomes that, you know, that greatly distorted, those virtues that we have accrued before do not stay upon that mind. You know, so in that sense, the mind being too stirred up. So we've mentioned the six preparatory practices together with the seven limbs. Another point that Jamsa Rinpoche was speaking of yesterday is the point with respect to restraining our senses and so forth. So it is found in our text from page 101, I believe. All right, what to do in between meditation sessions, that begins in page 100. So in between meditation session, we restrain our sense faculties, we act with vigilance, we also observe an appropriate diet, and we also practice diligently without sleeping at the wrong time, and we act properly at the time of sleep. Now, all of these branches are branches that will aid, that will support the development of the union of karma, abiding, and special insight, which is what we need to develop in order to become a Buddha. So we use those branches in between our meditation sessions so that will supplement the actual practice of the cultivation of karma, abiding, and special insight. So we begin with in-between sessions restraining our sense faculties. So we recognize how, to begin with, as beginners, when our sense faculties are not restrained, we find it, we find that afflictions easily rise in our mind, and then we get involved with inappropriate behavior. There is one quotation that is found in the text on the Stairs of the Path that speaks of how our habitual tendencies, those negative tendencies, contribute to afflictive states. So we can see how, for example, when we encounter object of the senses, be they attractive objects or unattractive objects, afflictions easily arise, attachment, anger, and so forth. Like, for example, with respect to a person that you dislike, the advice that you get is if there's a certain person that upon meeting that person, an anger would arise in your mind, then first of all, avoid encountering that person so that you do not give anger an avenue for rising. So this is the first practice or the first advice here, restraining our sense faculties. Also, on top of that, we can say that should you encounter a certain object that gives right to attachment in your mind, even if you then go away from that area, you don't see that object anymore, still by thinking about it again and again, attachment increases. Or you meet a certain person that you dislike, or you see a person that you dislike, even when they're not present anymore, if you think about them again and again, then anger still arises in your mind. So you need then to find ways to stop thinking of those objects, stop becoming mentally engaged with them, so that afflictions will not increase in that way. But then for us, you could say that it's those that just begin with that, those practices are, you say, the thing that suits us the best at this level, in the sense that there's nothing more that we can do, is make sure that we avoid encountering those objects that trigger our afflictions from the outset, right? So avoid those opportunities, make sure that those opportunities of encountering objects of desire, objects of attachment, make sure that you avoid opportunities for encountering them. So the second point that is mentioned with respect to what we're doing in between meditation session is acting vigilantly with respect to the phone, The word for vigilance in Tibetan is shishing, which has a connotation of acting knowingly, right? So you always know what you're doing. In that sense, looking at the target audience for the teaching on the success of the path as composed by Lama Tsongkhapa. Lama Tsongkhapa was speaking, you can say, by and large, to a community of monastics. So a community of monastics, fully ordained or novices, have those stipulated rules with respect to what they can do and what they ought not to do. So they should act vigilantly, knowing what are the boundaries of their actions, and act accordingly. But also for lay people, this is also applicable, in that if you think to yourself, I'm a follower of the Buddha and therefore I have a certain mode of conduct that I need to uphold, then knowingly you uphold that conduct, so you act with vigilance. So if, as a monastic, for example, as a fully ordained, in your set of rules, there are, for example, rules with respect to you can go into town or in the village before noon, but you are not allowed to go into town after noon. Now, those rules basically can deal with one's code of conduct of collecting alms. You might be permitted to go into town before noon, before 12 o'clock, in order to go on alms round. But afternoon, 2, 3 o'clock and so forth, they say that do not do that, because that's already past the time that you're supposed to go on alms.
So,
Now the next branch that Lama Tsongkhapa explained is how to observe the inappropriate diet. Now, there's no need to go into great details with respect to that. It's found in a text on page 105. We are quite knowledgeable about how to sustain a healthy diet. In Nagarjuna's letter to a friend, there are also a couple of verses that explain the way that one should approach eating the food. And the emphasis is having eating one's food without being subject to a sense of attachment. Not being attached to the food that we eat, not being attached to the flavors, the tastes, and so forth, but to consider the food as sustenance for the body, so that when we think of our objectives in terms of this and future lifetimes, we are, you know, we aspire to rely upon food so that we will be of benefit to ourselves and others as much as we can here and hereafter in this and future lives. Now, the last point in that section, point D, explains how to practice diligently without sleeping at the wrong time and how to act properly at the time of sleep. So, how to practice diligently without sleeping at the wrong time refers to the times in which you're awake and the times that you're supposed to be asleep. You could say that probably between 9 to 3 a.m. are the hours in which you should be asleep, and then you rise up. You know, let's say you rise up early morning, you know, 4 or 5 and so forth, and you first of all do some recitations or some practices, then you have your breakfast, then you know, in that sense, you construct your meditation sessions over the day. You might do some study and some meditation. It seems that this section is oriented towards the idea that you would do four sessions a day. So this is how you would construct a day if you do four sessions of practice. Also, yesterday, Kabje Rinpoche explains the posture that we adopt as we lie down to our sleep. So we spoke about the lying posture in which we lie down on the right side of the body. Our head is supported by the right hand. The left leg is resting on the right leg. So there's also, in some sense, correlation to contemporary science. It is said that Geshe-la had some scientists speaking about it in relation to the system of neurons that run through our body. So the right-hand side is connected with states such as anger, attachment, and so forth, whereas the left side is connected with positive states of mind, compassion, love, and so forth. So if you think about it, if you're lying down on your right side, then your left side is pressing down on it, so that it's pressing down on those neurons or that neuron system that is connected with afflictive states of mind. So in that sense, it is said that if you adopt that lying posture, your afflictions will become weaker. This is how it is explained from a Buddhist perspective. So we can also draw some parallels from between that explanation and how it is viewed from the perspective of some scientists, that you press down on those neurons that are more connected with afflictive states of mind.
sacrificio per come è fatto il corpo rispetto alle mentalità.
So then, in relation to that, we then study the different states of mind that we have. We study about afflictions and secondary afflictions. When you approach that topic from the point of view of a topic that is called in Tibetan Lorig, awareness and knowers, and minds and mental factors, you learn the presentation of the six root afflictions and the secondary, the 20 secondary afflictions. So within the six root afflictions, we have hostility and attachment and ignorance and doubt and views. So we look at the six root afflictions and the secondary, the 20 secondary afflictions such as belligerence and spite and jealousy and so forth. So it is important to study this presentation. We call it, from Isona Santos calls it the science of the mind. We seek to transform our mind, and actually without knowing what the mind is in terms of what types of mental factors we have, what are the root afflictions, what are the 20 secondary afflictions, we will not have a lot to work with, right? Our ability to work with the mind would be quite limited, because we, for example, seek to develop an understanding of what states of mind we need to develop in order to provide the mind with some support, with positive support, and what states of mind we can develop in order to undermine, in order to harm negative states of mind. So without that knowledge, our scope will be quite limited. The presentation of minds and mental factors is crucial. It is found in Asanga's Abhidhamma Samuchaya. And when you study it in the classics, you study it in looking at what Asanga said. But also for us now, there are a lot of presentations, succinct presentation of minds and mental factors, which Geshe-la recommends studying. So you have those presentations, succinct presentations that were composed by contemporary scholars, Tibetan scholars, and no, they're not that heavy or that thick. Now, an advice that is given here with respect to our meditation practice, we might take up a certain meditation practice in Tibetan Sanskrit, it's called our recitations, our prayers. But no, in that meditation practice, we might be meditating on topics such as the way to rely upon a spiritual teacher. So we might get distracted in a meditation and our mind will wander off to other objects that are still virtuous. So you might be thinking that since those objects are still virtuous, it is still permissible to entertain, but actually, even if your mind wanders off to other virtues and to other objects and their virtues, it's still a hindrance to your meditation. So you should prevent that mental rumination, even if that rumination occurs with respect to virtuous objects. For if you entertain that, if you allow that to continue for the rest of your life, you will not be able to elicit the fullest potential of your meditation. So keep your meditation bound to the object of meditation that you resolved, and do not allow your mind to wander.
In quel momento noi ci siamo prefissi di andare nella direzione di comprendere, analizzare e sviluppare quei punti del modo corretto di affidarsi al maestro spirituale. Per cui quella è una distrazione, dobbiamo riportare la mente sopra e andare in quella direzione. Se non facciamo così, non riusciremo mai a portare qualche risultato nella nostra mente con le meditazioni che facciamo, perché la mente continuerà a saltare da una parte e dall'altra senza arrivare al suo scopo preciso, okay? Questo è molto importante, per cui non seguire la mente, non fare in modo che la mente non segua le emozioni distruttive, e nel momento in cui ti sei prefisso il percorso, fare in modo che la mente non vada in un altro percorso, anche se può essere virtuoso nello stesso modo. You might be thinking that this is pretty hard to prevent the mind from wandering off to other objects, even if they are virtuous objects. Now, how hard it is to arrest that mental rumination. Yeah, we can admit that it is difficult. It is in no way an easy thing to do. Even if the mind wanders off to virtuous objects, we should not entertain that. We should still, as much as we can, try to arrest that mental wandering and to make it stick with the object of meditation. So we can understand how hard it is. Sorry, before we get to that, also Geshe said that if you find in your meditation, at a certain time, that it is too difficult, it is also permissible to take a break. So you might take a break, allow your mind to rest for some time, and you might in that time allow the mind to be engaged with another thing that is virtuous. But when the mind is well rested, then again you assign the mind to the virtuous object that you have selected, and you arrest rumination as much as you can. So when you study the presentation of minds and mental factors, you then become knowledgeable. You get the sense of how hard it is, what we're up against. It is in no way easy. You adopt a rather vast and spacious and relaxed attitude with respect to what you need to be doing, in a sense that you understand the enormity, how grave our situation is in terms of our afflictive states of mind, because afflictive states of mind are cunning states of mind. They're always seeking an opportunity to arise. They're rushing up and seeking an opportunity to get the way in. So even when we're engaged in virtuous actions, such as, for example, when we make offerings, when we arrange an altar, arrange offering on the altar, we might then
have an affliction arising kind of thing, and that I want to arrange it in such a way that others will come to appreciate me, how wonderful or how nicely I arrange those offerings. So even with virtuous activities, our afflictions are still seeking an opportunity to arise. So it's good to also recognize that, and you come to recognize it when you study the presentation of mental factors. So in that sense, it gives you more to work with in your meditation, but also in your approach to meditation. Now, also, I guess I wanted to correct a mistake that I made yesterday. He said that we spoke about the depiction of the wheel of life and the ways to attend karma abiding, and so that you guys also have it here in the center. He had a look again at the painting that he had. It was not a painting of that winding road that is depicts the way to attend karma abiding. It's actually a depiction of the four harmonious friends. So, Geshe said that one of the advice that His Honor gave with respect to our approach to karma abiding and special needs, that he said that nowadays in India, there are those famous Hindu practitioners or Hindu scholars that run those courses, or you know, they advocate those methods that are similar to karma abiding special insight. Geshe mentioned those names, but no, I'm not familiar with those names. Bibhusana, something like that. Probably Fabrizio knows them better, but it seems that the What is honest is that in the Tibetan world, there are quite a lot of scholars that are very skilled in the teaching of Karma Bhatting and Special Insight, but the practice, the actual practice of that is not commonly found. So, right, so you find a lot of explanation, but the practitioners are actually quite a few. Whereas if you look at what's happening in India amongst Indian Hindu practitioners, this is, say, you can also call them Tirthikas or outsiders, non-Buddhists. They have a lot of practice. They're still doing that practice. So it's honest as actually, it's good to look around at what they're doing, not to participate in some of those courses, to look at what they're doing, and also to then go back to your own tradition and see how what Lama Tsongkhapa explained in his text on Lamrim, for example, Lamrim Chemo and other texts as well, is also pointing out faults in the system and teaches how to practice that properly. So it seems that we're way over time now. Geshe-la's initial intention was to leave more time today for Q&A because we haven't got to do it yesterday, but as it happens, it's now more than 20 minutes past the time that we should have stopped. So he is intending to do it better tomorrow. So if you have any questions, please prepare them beforehand.
Sangye shindu mikte uwagi droko namda shin lache pashu idam guru rana mandala kamniya yatayami ngevadi nyodo dang lama sangye drum gyone drowa chinkya malupa neye salagyo pashu janchup semchok rinpoche ma kye panam ge gyo chi kye pan yam pa me pa yang gane gondro pelwashu.